This is Studio 2 on the road, where today we are live and on location in Montgomery County. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. All right, folks. Just about 2 weeks, right? Just about 2 weeks. In this hour, we're going to talk about the role Pennsylvania will play in determining the next president of the United States, and specifically, the impact of voters here in the Philadelphia suburbs.
The latest polls show that the race between Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump is extremely tight. And with Pennsylvania's 19 electoral college votes up for grabs, both candidates have been spending a lot of time in the Philadelphia area recently doing whatever they can to increase their margins.
For instance, here was Kamala Harris last week in Washington Crossing, Bucks County, touting her support from multiple prominent Republicans and borrowing some language from Ronald Reagan.
Imperfect though we may be, America is still that shining city upon a hill that inspires people around the world. And I do believe it is one of the highest forms of patriotism to fight for the ideals of our country.
And here was Donald Trump over the weekend at the McDonald's in Feasterville, where he worked the French fry station and drive-thru window for 25 minutes for pre-selected customers. Take a listen.
I love McDonald's. I love jobs. I like to see good jobs. Well, that's a good-looking group. Hello, everybody. This is all on Trump.
Oh, all on Trump.
I'm allowed to do that, right?
Yeah.
Huh?
Let's check and make sure. It's everything you said it would be.
It better be. It's going to be the best you ever. I made it myself.
You're the man. Make America great.
That's their order. Thank you, man. Thank you.
So clearly the candidates understand that every vote matters in Pennsylvania. And that's why we've been hitting the streets and working the phones to talk to people across the region about what's motivating them to cast their ballot. Now let's check out this montage of people we talked to from Bucks to Chester, to Lancaster, to Luzerne, to Erie counties.
COVID, that was a prime example. He got on the air and started saying things that weren't true.
So Trump is more harsh, but more real. Harris is complete disaster.
Democrats care about people. She's supporting small businesses.
Everything's really expensive right now. We have a baby, another one coming, so it's definitely hard for our family. Under Trump, he will take care of us.
The disgrace was January 6th. That's a disgrace. That was an attack on the heart of our country.
To be honest, I don't really care how good of a person my president is if the gas is almost $4 a gallon.
I'm thinking about future generations, and I think it's absurd that Roe versus Wade was overturned.
So we're going to hear more from voters later in this program, but right now we want to introduce our panelists who will help us understand what's at stake in this election and analyze how Democrats and Republicans are strategizing when it comes to getting out the vote here in the suburbs.
First, we have Jamila Winder, a Montgomery County commissioner. She's an elected Democrat who is the first African-American woman in the county's history to serve on the board. She has also been active in organizing support for Kamala Harris during this campaign. Jamila, welcome.
Hi, Montgomery County.
Next to her, we have Dave Galuch, who is part of the Delaware County Republican Party Executive Committee. He is a Naval Academy grad who specialized in disarming bombs during several overseas deployments. He also ran unsuccessfully for Congress in 2022. For the 5th Congressional District here in Pennsylvania. Dave, welcome.
And last but not least, we have Katie Meyer, the government editor and reporter for the news organization Spotlight PA and a friend of Studio 2. Got to mention that Katie's team helped gather some of the tape from swing and undecided voters across the state, including some of the voices we just heard, and we'll hear insights from her about them throughout this program. Katie, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So I am going to go out on a limb and start with some math. Not my strong suit, but so if you go back to 2012, that presidential election, if you recall, it was Barack Obama versus Mitt Romney. And if you add up all of the four collar counties in the Philadelphia suburbs, Democrats carried those four counties by about 123,000 votes. Now let's fast forward to 2020, the last presidential election. That number went from 123,000 to 293,000, more than double in 8 years, looking at that margin. So I want to ask our panelists, starting with Katie Meyer, what happened?
I mean, I think the biggest thing, and I think this is also something that a lot of folks in this room might be aware of in some way or another, is that we've seen a big political realignment in those years. I think the Trump presidency really kind of put it into focus for a lot of folks, but it was starting before then, and it has since continued unabated, which is that the type of voter who votes for Democrats and who votes for Republicans has really shifted. And so years ago, the Philadelphia suburbs were strongly Republican counties, but they weren't that different from what they are now. It was mostly college-educated voters, or at least a lot of them. It was voters who, compared with the rest of the state, tended to be a little bit more well-off. And those are factors that really predict how you vote. And what we've seen, though, is that it the way that you vote, if you are that kind of person, has changed. So where that kind of voter used to be predominantly Republican, now they are predominantly Democrats. And I should say, I mean, the suburbs, like any part of the state, in any part of the country, it's never just one kind of voter. They are diverse. Different pockets of the suburbs are very different than other pockets. There are many, many different kinds of voters. The suburbs have gotten more diverse over the past, you know, couple of decades. But with those caveats, that's the general trend I think we've seen.
Dave, I'd love to hear your thoughts, because as a Republican, you must have been watching this blue wave with some trepidation. So what do you think are the driving factors here?
I think Katie brings up a lot of good points, and I think she got to the heart of the answer. You know, Delaware County used to be the reddest county in Pennsylvania. It was the beating heart of the Republican Party in Pennsylvania. Some people don't believe me when I say that, but it's true. But I think that it's interesting to see the shift going on. Obviously, the only constant in politics is that things are constantly changing. So we've seen the suburbs move away from the Republicans, relatively speaking. But we've seen areas of Pennsylvania, say like Southwest Pennsylvania, which was the bluest part of the state, now become ruby red. I have family from Elk County, Pennsylvania, a small town, called Johnsonburg, with a paper mill in it. It used to be one of the most D counties in the country. Now it is overwhelmingly Republican. So obviously the trends in one area, like Newton's law, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. You're seeing some changes across the state.
Jamila, what do you think? I mean, how do you explain to someone on the street why those margins change so dramatically, so fast?
When I was growing up in East Arden Township, it was predominantly Republican. And our communities have changed. You know, our friends and neighbors look different. We've got working class families throughout Montgomery County. So it really is that the Democrats and the demographics have changed and evolved. And I've witnessed that in the 4 decades that I've been in Montgomery County. And so I look at where I live in East Arden Township. It was, you know, still predominantly white, but the people that are now living there, we flipped that township, as an example, from red to blue about a decade ago.
And so, Dave, I want to bring you back into the conversation. Republicans have seemed to see some opportunity here for the 2024 election. What has been the challenge in the collar counties, and what are those opportunities?
I think it's important to highlight. I think really the salient factor driving the realignment now is not so much race. It's, the level of credentialing or schooling you have, right? College-educated voters, especially post-grad voters, tend to be much more Democrat, whereas if you have some college or less, you tend to be more Republican now. And this is something that, again, is very has been present in our politics forever. Look at John Quincy Adams versus Andrew Jackson in 1824. You have a party that is sort of the experts of a higher income versus a more populist party. This has been the dichotomy of U.S. politics for our entire history, so this is nothing new. But in terms of factors which I think may be tailwinds for the Republican Party, you know, the suburbs are not monolithic, right? So we do have a lot of working class areas of the suburbs, and I'll take Delaware County, my own county. You know, Sun Shipbuilding in Chester used to employ like 10,000 people. They built the Liberty ships that won the Second World War. There used to be a Ford plant there. There used to be a Scott Paper Company plant there. These jobs have gone away. We have a oil refinery in Trainer, Pennsylvania, which supports 5,000 jobs that is now perpetually under risk of closing. A lot of Trump's message, a lot of the more populist message appeals to people in that part of the county. Why? Because they've experienced the post-industrial society. They've experienced what happens when you have jobs that leave.
The big question I have is when I look at that number, that margin from 2020, that 290-some thousand votes, the question I keep asking myself is, have Democrats sort of hit their electoral ceiling in the color counties? They've turned out everyone they could turn out. They flipped everyone they could flip. Or have things happened in the last 4 years that will continue to turn suburban voters a little bit bluer? What do you think, Jamila?
You know, there's always an opportunity to convert people, you know, on the ground. You know, I've been talking a lot about to get independents, Republicans, or even people that are saying, I'm just going to sit this one out because
right. mm-hmm.
I don't love either candidate, really being able to meet voters where they are and talk about the issues that, you know, are keeping them up at night, not grandstanding on big national issues, but what are the issues that are, Americans are facing regardless of who you vote for.
Katie, I wanted to ask you how the collar counties compare to state numbers and when it comes to political leanings. And some of your reporting on voter registration statewide, you said in the past 26 years, Democrats have never had as small an advantage as they do now. So it seems like the trend is going the opposite in the collar counties. So give us some comparison about this area versus the state.
Democrats in the past year or so have seen pretty dismal registration numbers, and that's statewide. That's not in the collar counties. In the collar counties, things are stronger, but I would say that like it's not as much of a strong number as many Democrats would like to see. So basically, what Democrats have seen over the last century or so is a couple very big registration spikes. And after those spikes, we see corrections. So one big spike happened among the baby boomer generation, and it was from like the 60s to the 80s as these people were coming of age. And this was at a time in Pennsylvania where labor was really strong, organized labor was really mm-hmm. strong, and organized labor drove registration in the Democratic Party. If you were a good union member, often you were a good union Democrat. And so it's a huge generation. It was a lot of people who worked in the trades. A lot of them registered as Democrats, but they didn't always keep voting that way. And so we haven't really seen the effect of that registration bump in effect in a long time. But what we are seeing now is people getting older, people sometimes leaving the state to be closer to relatives, people passing away, people finally changing their registration. Because they feel like it doesn't, align with their political views anymore. So that's one bump that we're now seeing a correction for. The other one's more recent. It's the Obama-era bump. Yep. The Obama administration yep. had incredibly high voter turnout efforts in, 2008 to 2012. A lot of the people they registered were really young. Maybe they've since left the state. Maybe they don't see themselves as active voters or as Democrats anymore. More frequently, if they left the state a couple registration cycles after that, they get cleaned from the rolls because they didn't stay active. So that's just a natural flow of registration trends. And so we see Democrats just sort of pushing downward, and it's bad news for them, for sure. They have not had good registration numbers this year, but it's not as dismal as it probably looks. It's probably just a correction. And then Republicans saw a big registration boost when Trump first ran for office. And so that's still sort of pushing upward, as one of the demographers that I talked to has said. So anyway, registration trends, they don't mean everything, but they are interesting.
They might mean something.
Yeah. They mean something.
I think they mean something.
Yeah, Dave thinks they mean something.
Many Republicans think they mean something.
But Dave, you were saying actually, even in deep blue Delco, right, you are starting to see some signs of Republican resilience, which might suggest that ceiling I talked about earlier, perhaps Democrats are starting to bump up against it, at least in Delco. Can you explain?
Yeah, I think so we had a registration gain relative to the Democrats for the second week in a row. And that's the first time I can remember that ever happening.
But it's against the pattern.
That's correct. So even in Delco. And then just in terms of 2024 and in terms of hitting ahead on the ceiling, if you will, I think that the key demographic in the collar counties will be the sort of swing voters who say voted for Trump in 16 and then voted for Biden in 2020. I think that a decent number of those folks are actually still up for grabs. And I think that as that group goes, that will determine whether or not Harris sees even a larger margin than in 2020, or if Trump sees something closer than what he got in the collar counties in 2016.
I actually want to roll in some clips now, because this will be the first presidential election in which candidates will have the opportunity to run on or run against the overturning of Roe versus Wade. We did see it boost Democrats in the 2022 election, helping them stave off an expected red wave in Congress, and this might have gone a little bit under the radar, helping them take control of the Pennsylvania State House. Roe's a big part of that shift. We want to hear two women with different views on abortion now. Both have been Republican voters in the past, but one changed dramatically in recent years. First up, let's hear Lisa Franklin, 44 years old, from Luzerne County in northeastern Pennsylvania.
Right after, in June of 2022, I said to myself, there's no way that I could vote Republican or conservatively, as I have in prior elections, because of this matter with Roe v. Wade. That was it right there and then. I think it is inhumane the way that women are being treated right now.
So now let's hear from Carly Snyder. She's 31 years old. She's a stay-at-home mom from Bristol, Pennsylvania. She's been a consistent Trump voter over the years. She praises him for picking U.S. Supreme Court justices that struck down federal abortion rights.
I don't want to be labeled as a conservative. I don't want to be labeled as a Republican. But my faith determines how I vote, and life is very important, and I'm looking at the way Roe v. Wade was overturned during his time. I think that he could be a little more pro-life.
So, Dave, I'm going to put this to you now, because I
mentioned
that number.
It's an easy question, I'm sure.
293,000. That was the margin in the suburbs before January 6th and before the overturning of Roe. Those seem like those could be pretty big pivot points for your typical suburban swing voter. Do you think the Republicans can overcome that? Are you worried about that?
Well, certainly you always have to be worried about the issues you're vulnerable on. And at least on the abortion issue, I think the Republicans have done a good job in the postmortem after 2022 of just understanding how much trust we need to gain back in the eyes of the public on this issue. I know J.D. Vance, I think, actually used that exact line in his debate, and he's right. We have a lot of work to do. You know, ultimately, we have differing views of morality on this issue. And I don't want to make the issue, you know, contentious. This is that we have to turn the temperature down on this issue. We have to have a conversation, and I think we can do that now that the issue is back at the state. You know, we don't anticipate Pennsylvania's abortion law changing. To do so would take one party to have all both of the houses, and then obviously the governor's office as well. But I think we have to turn the temperature down on the issue, focus on the areas we can agree, and then continue to move forward as we would with all the other contentious issues
and on
we
that
also
point,
have to agree with.
I want to put this now to Katie Meyer, because we saw in the suburbs specifically, in the gubernatorial race in 2022, even larger margins for Democrats, 387,000. I mean, and that's in a low turnout election. That said, it was right after the decision, right, Katie Meyer? And in a sense, abortion access, you could argue, was more on the ballot because the governor has a tangible role to play in whether or not Pennsylvania's law changes. So do you think the 2022 effect could carry over to 2024? Are there challenges for Democrats moving that momentum from one race to the other?
Yeah, I mean, it was a very different election in 2022. As Avi said, it was a live issue at the time. Roe had just been overturned. We had two candidates for governor who had starkly different positions on abortion. Josh Shapiro, the Democrat who ended up winning, did not want any restrictions. And Doug Mastriano, the Republican who lost by a lot, was extremely conservative on abortion and outspoken about it when a lot of Republicans had already sort of tried to start backpedaling on the issue. And he supported like a 6-week ban. And so I think voters were really decisive that year. The other thing that I would just kind of bring in is that at the time, the legislature was controlled by Republicans in both chambers. Now it's very narrowly controlled by Democrats in the House, and that could shift again this year. But again, it felt like a real issue at the time. I would say for voters this year, I mean, for sure, there are still questions on abortion. Kamala Harris has said she would want to put in federal protections. That depends on whether you think Congress can act on something like that, which has looked unlikely. So I think it's, no, of course, not settled on the national level, but in Pennsylvania, there's less of a chance that that anything will really happen in the near future. And so what does that mean for voters? I think voters do know that. I think the temperature maybe has come down. People have adjusted. And so there's a real question of whether it will be as inspiring an issue for as many voters this year. In the conversations that I had, though, I will say, I mean, people are still thinking about it. That was one voice that you heard. It was a voter whose mind had absolutely been changed. I think it's one of those issues where it's difficult to take down the temperature because it feels extremely life or death for a lot of people. And, you know, it's an extremely, you know, it's a big decision. It's for women, for people who are making those kinds of decisions, I think it feels very close to home. So anyway, I think it'll always be a big issue. I think there's just no way to make it not a big issue. Will it be as big? I don't know.
And Jamila, I saw you taking notes and moving around a little bit. Did you want to respond to that?
It's absolutely on the ballot. When you think about our rights as Americans, right? Fundamental rights are at risk. And the president, you know, has the opportunity to put Supreme Court justices that roll back the rights that my ancestors fought so hard for. So, you know, that's what I'm hearing people think about. You know, I think about, you know, I lost my 104-year-old grandmother this past April, and I think about the freedoms that she fought for so that I might sit here today. And so when you think about it in that context and you think about women's rights, voting rights, civil rights, you know, we can all think about an ancestor or someone who came before us who fought for the rights that we hold dear today. And those are the things that when we elect our president, when we elect our senators, you know, our rights are in their hands.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
Now, let's get back to the Studio 2 on the Road event we recorded Monday night at the Upper Dublin Library. There, we hosted a panel including Montgomery County Commissioner Jamila Winder, Delaware County GOP Executive Committee member Dave Galuch, and Spotlight PA editor and reporter Katie Meyer.
Jerry kicks us back off here with a question about the growing partisan gender gap.
And I want to bring up the gender issue here in Pennsylvania. 57% of women favor Harris. 53% of the state's men favor Trump. I want to talk about suburban women, Katie.
Yeah.
Talk about the influence that suburban women are having and how that has shifted over the past couple of elections.
I don't know if I can give you any numbers or anything, but I will say I talked to voters who, like, were having this conflict in their own homes. You know, a woman who was, like, undecided but was like, my husband really likes Trump, and I don't want to know what I'm going to do, and we can't talk about it anymore. And so I think that's a real thing that households in a swing state are experiencing. But I think there are certain issues that inspire people to come out and vote. Abortion is certainly one of them. Female voters in the suburbs are very high turnout voters, so of course they make a difference.
Yeah, and Dave, any comment on how Republicans, the strategy of closing that gender gap? And the same question, of course, to Jamila.
Yeah.
Is that gender gap.
Yeah. I mean, I was raised by a mom in the suburbs. I was raised by a single mom. My dad actually passed away before I was born, so it was just her and I growing up. And she always worked two jobs, and I remember listening through the bedroom door hearing her cry because she was so stressed out about how hard it was to raise me. And I think a lot of moms have had that same reaction over the last 4 years, increased cost of living, an economy that's not really working for enough folks, especially like her. So there are a lot more issues than, you know, just the choice issue, which are going to affect the suburban woman, inflation being one of them, the border being another, crime being another, obviously, which, you know, I think in a lot of people's eyes have gone in the wrong direction over the last 4 years. So there's a litany of issues that I think apply to everyone.
And the strategy for closing that gender gap is to highlight those issues?
Absolutely.
What are you saying?
Absolutely.
And then, Jamila, the men have seemed to continue to drift away from the Democratic Party. What is the Democratic message to men? And I would maybe put a finer point on it, young men.
Mm-hmm. So it's interesting. You know, the Democrats have spent a lot of time focusing on being the party of inclusion, having more diversity in our candidate pool. And I remember when I was running for election, you know, talking to some younger white males, being concerned about, you know, what's left for me, right? Making sure that the Democrat Party still has opportunities for young white males. Look, we're talking to, you know, our fathers, our sons, right? I think that's an opportunity to give men, both Democrats and Republicans, a level of comfort with having a woman in the highest office of the land. I think there are real fears about having a woman, a black woman, no matter how competent she is, having her run our country. That is real. And so I want to say that I think so it's a matter of getting white younger males, right, to see the stark contrast and how the Democratic Party and this ticket will be a party for all.
Let's actually bring in the voice of that voter that mm-hmm. Katie mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. This is Diane Josepher. She's from Chester County in her early 70s, lifelong registered Democrat, but feels more aligned with Republicans these days. She did vote for Democrat Josh Shapiro for governor, thinks he's doing a great job, but she has problems with many Dems on the national stage. That said, there's also a lot she does not like about Donald Trump. So let's play that tape.
Sometimes I'm leaning towards Trump, and then sometimes I'm leaning toward Harris. When he was saying things about them eating dogs and cats, I mean, that was crazy. So that kind of makes me think, you know, what's going on with him? I always say to my husband, if he would keep his mouth shut half the time, he would be unbeatable. Because he does love this country. I mean, it was crazy. And his followers are a little crazy, just like the march on the Capitol. I mean, he incites people that are a bit off the wall. I don't like either one, honestly. I don't think that she answers the questions. She gets asked a lot of questions by the media, and she doesn't answer them. And she doesn't have plans for the future. And I think the foreign countries are going to see her as being weak.
Wow. Okay, both of you have to try to win over Diane.
Diane is the median Pennsylvania.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about these bellwether counties. There's a bellwether human right there, Diane. So I'll let both of you go, Jamila, then Dave. I mean, what would be your message to that voter?
So if I was knocking on Diane's door, and I was canvassing, and I was trying to convince her, you know, I would take a minute and just listen to what she has to say, and then be able to really overcome that with facts. Kamala Harris does have a plan. She's clearly outlined that plan, and it's just a matter of helping people understand that plan. There's so much noise that the important stuff is getting lost in translation. So if I was talking to Diane, I would give very concrete examples of why Kamala Harris is, you know, the best person for the job. I would talk about, you know, her agenda, her policy point of view. And, you know, I forget what she said about Trump, if he would just keep his mouth
Yeah. Mouth shut. He'd be unbeatable, I think, is what
he'd be unbeatable. I don't know about that, but if I was talking to Diane, it's just, you know, you meet misinformation or perception with facts.
Yeah,
and that's what we're trying to do as Democrats on the ground.
I mean, Dave, that's such an interesting point, though. If he would keep his mouth shut, he'd be unbeatable. Because I actually think he also does derive some power from the way he speaks. People see it as direct. A lot of people do relate to it, but there's that double-edged sword, of course, of then a lot of people are turned off by his word choice. So how would you convince Diane?
Yeah, I think first, again, I try and just tell people, look, you know, no matter if you support Trump or Harris, we're all Americans at the end of the day, right? We all love the same country. We're all trying to do the same thing. And politics can't feel like this total win or total loss kind of game we're into right now. But look, I think I would also probably lean on the facts. You know, I would probably ask her, you know, who do you feel like you were doing better in terms of take-home pay under Joe Biden and Kamala Harris or under Donald Trump? Do you think the border was safer and more secure under Donald Trump, or do you think it was safer under Kamala Harris? Do you believe the world was more stable? Do you believe there were less conflicts, less wars going on under Donald Trump or under Kamala Harris? You know, I guess I would just say, you know, Harris, she has sort of backtracked on almost every major issue and position she took in 2020. And I would simply ask, you know, it's very difficult to trust someone to do tomorrow what they had the power to do yesterday. She's been in office for 3.5 years, and I think the facts speak for themselves.
Yeah. All due respect, Trump backpedals all the time, right? Like he
backpedals. So you guys are both at our door now. Yeah. Diane's like, oh no. Those are good. I think those were good synopses of what the closing arguments are for each side, or what the sides hope the closing arguments will be. Right. Obviously, other things can intervene.
Yeah, and I want to talk about the number of people who are undecided, just so small at this point. So I want to talk about the get out the vote effort, the turnout a little bit, because we hear your arguments. You're going door to door to get every little voter. But the collar counties in Philadelphia, a third of the votes in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And I want you to talk about, because the couch is also a competing factor in this. And in order for either side to win, they need turnout in these counties. And so what is your message to voters who maybe they're not necessarily undecided, but the couch is calling them?
The couch. Well, I guess I'll take that one first. In terms of the mail-in vote and the early vote in Pennsylvania, the Republican Party is up significantly over its 2020 and 2022 numbers, and that's because of a very robust targeting effort that we have been implementing really over the last year, or preparing over the last year and then rolling out now. So I think you'll see our percentage of the mail-in vote increase by 7 to 10%, I think, is what the data is right now. So that certainly helps us in needing to generate a lower election day margin in the past. But this is why you have party organizations. You know, this is why you have committee people who knock on their neighbor's door when new people move in on the street, right, to introduce yourself, to get to know people, to try and meet them where they're at and to understand who they are. So during the election season, you can help to get them out to vote. So that's what we're focused on, knocking doors, targeting voters, and trying to be hyper-focused on the persuadable universe of folks who we think we can still get.
And Jamila, how are you getting people out? Because I know you're going to a lot of events almost every day, but how are you ensuring that those touch points, those text messages, all the, you know, commercials we're seeing is going to mean a vote for your candidates?
Yeah, that's the thing. You know, there's so much information overload, you know, coming on TV, on social media. And so I would agree that our party apparatus, our Democratic Party apparatus, is a beast. I look at the work that Democrats have done, you know, over decades to really build party. And so we have a force of close to 750 committee people, myself being one of them, that are doing the work to cut through, you know, all the TV ads, all the polls, and knocking on doors. The number of canvas launches we have, the number of get out the vote rallies that we have that are targeting not, you know, the super Dems, but targeting people that we need to get off the couch, that we need to, the people that we need to get excited about what our candidate will do for them. So we're doing, it's really a ground game.
Look, this is kind of a nerdy, hyper-focused election question, but I would love for each of you, Dave and Jamila, to like give me a township, a borough, maybe even a neighborhood where you're like, this is where we can make inroads, where we can make this little part of the suburbs a little redder or a little bluer than it was 4 years ago. Like I say that to you, Dave, like what's the city, what's the borough, what's the township that pops to mind and why?
So I will answer your question with a Philly ward that borders Delaware County and then the townships across of Cobbs Creek or across from Cobbs Creek from it. But I would say the 40th Ward of Philadelphia is where I'll be watching on election night.
40th Ward.
Yes.
So you're talking about
Southwest Philadelphia.
Yeah.
I will be watching that on election night. That is an area of Philly where in 2012, Mitt Romney got precisely zero votes in some of the precincts down there. If the movement among black voters is real, you're going to see it there. You'll see it in wards like the 38th, the 11th, and some North Philly wards as well. But I'll be watching the 40th Ward and then wards in Upper Darby, Yaden, Collingdale, Sharon Hill, sort of the inner ring suburbs of Delaware County that tend to be more diverse.
Edge of Philly, inner ring Delco. All right, so John King, CNN, if you're listening to this, that's where you need to focus in that map.
So if Trump is able to get even 15% out of or 18% out of the 40th Ward, it's probably going to be a good night for the Republicans.
Yeah. Jamila, what do you think?
So I'll say my grandmother lived in that section of the city. So if she was still alive, she'd probably vote for Kamala. But what I would say is Norristown, like I think of our county seat, right? There's such diversity in terms of the families and the community that is there. You've got a large Latino population, a large black population, great for like first-time home buyers, working families. But, you know, depending on the election, they don't turn out in as high numbers as like a lower Marion township, right? And so I'm going to be watching and counting on Norristown as a borough, as an example, because, you know, the things that these two candidates are talking about are going to really affect those communities.
Now, the correct answer was Upper Dublin, Fort Washington.
Oh, yes. Oh, and Upper Dublin.
No, those are great answers. Those are great insights. And it gives you a sort of peek into how folks who are really inside these campaigns and inside these parties look at election night. So that's something perhaps we can learn from.
Yeah, and we're about to open it up for questions from our audience. But I wanted to give each of you campaign strategists here an opportunity. If you were in charge, right, if you were in control of everything here in Pennsylvania, what would be your advice to your party's campaign? What would you say that they need to do to close the gap and get a W in Pennsylvania? And Jamila, I'll start with you.
That's a loaded.
But you're in charge. No, you're in charge.
I'm in charge.
Yes.
You know, I think one thing that we've been coaching, you know, the campaign on, because, you know, you've got local campaign staff on the ground thinking about where we're going to host certain events and such. If I was in charge in this final stretch, diversify where you're going, right, in the county. Because sometimes you tend to go to places that are familiar or places that have, you know, high turnout, but I'm encouraging the campaign, and if I was in charge, to find other pockets in Montgomery County to connect with voters, right? And so it's oftentimes like Lower Marion or Norristown. If I was in charge the last 2 weeks, I would be making sure that we're diversifying where we're at.
Okay, so Dave, you're in charge. What would you say?
Stay on message, be disciplined, keep your mouth shut when it's not helpful. And I would say most persuadable voters are folks who are not ideologues on a certain issue, right? So if you feel very strongly about a certain topic or policy point, you have probably already decided how you're voting. Most undecided voters tend to put a premium on character, on the disposition of the candidate or the message. And I would encourage our folks trying to convince the small sliver of folks who still don't know who they're voting for towards the end, right? Be a nice person. Make people feel comfortable, right? Be diplomatic and let people know we're here to work together.
We have time for a little bit of Q&A.
Yeah, hi, Jacob Simon. I'm visiting from Bucks County. I wanted to first thank the organizers and thank you for keeping this calm and civilized. I think it's refreshing. It is hard to come up with a balanced question, but you both mentioned the importance of facts. And it seems to be that both sides have a different set of facts.
The misinformation, right, and the constant work that we have to do as electeds, especially those sitting on boards of elections, to kind of combat the misinformation that is coming out from, you know, from both sides, it's quite troubling. And so, you know, all I can do personally is, you know, I can't be complicit when misinformation is being spread, whether it be at the boardroom, whether it be, you know, on social media. And so I think everybody has to do their part, to rely on trusted sources to get the facts. And I take my role as an elected very seriously, and not sitting on the sidelines and allowing misinformation to spread, because that creates dangerous scenarios for both sides. And we're seeing the tensions be quite high as we're assessing our election day security. So thank you for raising it.
Yeah, look, this brings to mind a story I saw a couple years ago. I saw a story that a diplomatic cable got declassified, talking about what Xi Jinping was telling his diplomats overseas. And he said the best way to beat the United States is to boil the frog. Right. So you turn the temperature up slowly, bit by bit by bit, and the frog doesn't notice. And then eventually, unfortunately, the frog passes away. You wouldn't believe the influence foreign intelligence agencies have on social media platforms, in every kind of media avenue and in our society today. Our foes are turning up the temperature on our differences, and they're making the difference between left and right significantly worse at the worst possible time. So if a crisis happens that, you know, they believe will benefit the right, they push out information that helps that. If something happens that they believe helps the left, they push that out because they benefit when there's so much information out there, people can't make sense of it. So we have to take these threats seriously. It's going to take bipartisanship, and it's just going to take a cold, sober analysis of what's actually going on, and we have to get back to doing that. So thank you for the question.
And that was the voice of Delaware County Republican Party Executive Committee member Dave Galuch. He was part of a live panel discussion we hosted Monday night at the Upper Dublin Library, along with Montgomery County Commissioner Jamila Winder and Spotlight PA editor and reporter Katie Meyer.
Special thanks to the staff of the Upper Dublin Library who partnered with us on the event, and to everyone who came out to see us live. We so enjoy getting to meet our listeners in real life.
We so do. And the next Studio 2 On the Road event will be at the Indian Valley Public Library in Telford on November 12th. We will be processing the results of the election with a panel that includes former Pennsylvania Governor Mark Schweiker.
Looking forward to that event. And that wraps up our show for today. I want to say thank you, because Studio 2 is produced by Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Al Banks engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Tomorrow, we're talking about food.
Yes.
A palate cleanser. Thanks for joining us today. We'll talk to you tomorrow.